It's a difference between having a map of a territory and having a guide take you through the actual territory. This is the classic symbolic metaphor that Korzybski used about 40, 45 years ago. And it's his statement, the map is not the territory. One has to keep reminding oneself in a mental world that the map is not the territory. That just because you can consult a map and you have the map does not mean that you know how to be there. To have a map of the city of Paris does not ensure that you're going to be able to live through the day in Paris. In other words, life is astonishingly prolix, whereas the idea of life tends to be very coherent. And if you base as a referent your feeling, your intuition of health on a map, you get completely stymied by life. Life is unfair. It just fudges all over the place. It does the impossible. It's paradoxical. It's a built-in neurosis. Maps are made to be folded up and put in the back pocket and at strategic junctures to be consulted, but you wouldn't want to live your life in terms of the map. Now, it's simple in terms of this statement, but you can see allegorically one has to keep slapping oneself awake in terms of the complete personality. The sound of the struggle. It is not an encyclopedia, but a guide to understanding. Admittedly, there are still large areas of ignorance in cell biology and many facts that cannot yet be explained. But these unresolved problems provide much of the excitement, and we have tried to point them out in a way that will stimulate readers to join in the enterprise of discovery. In other words, the unknown, instead of being intimidating, is an exciting aspect. It provides the variety, the newness, the freshness. So instead of the unknown intimidating us, it refreshes us. The very qualities that got us down are now exactly those qualities that lift us up. It's a whole radical empiricism. Go back to William James that I mentioned Thursday. It's a radical empiricism. The wholeness of the person functioning is a radical empiricism. In other words, spiritual man is made to go into the unknown. We are designed to go into the unknown. Instead of us being afraid of the unknown is our meat. It's exactly what we're really made for. It's like the great archetypal insight, the little blurb at the beginning of the classic Star Trek, to boldly go where man has never gone before, is a nice colloquial way of phrasing. We are made to boldly go where we have never gone before. I don't know how to emphasize it any more than what I've been doing, except maybe to remind you the polarity, the left and right, as a structural characteristic of us physiologically, renders balance as a dynamic purpose. In other words, when one has a polarized structure, when one has a left and a right, its tendency is for stasis. But if that stasis then is a kind of devolvement leading to death, cells that are not dynamic die. Cells whose membranes close off die. A body that doesn't have intercommunication dies. One can literally suffocate psychically. So that the polarity, the left and right, can lead to death or can lead to life dynamically, so that there's the whole sense that there is a vector of purposefulness, of dynamic energy that's characteristic of life, that also comes out of its polarity. The polarity leads to death, but also leads to life. Can go either way. The fact that the polarity has another polarity in its purpose, that's the archetype of the quaternary. And notice that the quaternary is always a double pair. It's not just four. The correct way to write it would not be four, but two squared. It's two times two. The mental idea, in a naive way, does not distinguish between 2 plus 2 equals 4 from 2 times 2 equals 4. It takes a little bit of learning, a little bit of sophistication to realize that there's a different process. Multiplication is a different process from addition. Just by adding things up, one leads to a stasis and a demise. It's by the dynamic multiplication that the same ingredients lead to life. So that life process is division and multiplication, whereas the structure in its archaic stasis is addition and subtraction. Always, though, you have two pairs of functions that go together. Just so in the psychological functional types, thought and feeling always go together, sensation and insight always go together. They're two pairs. So that when one is dealing with maturing a particular function, you have to mature the two functions together. Thought and feeling mature together. Sensation and insight mature together. Some of you who've worked with physiological work initially probably were surprised to find that manipulating the physical body yields insights. That the physical body is related organically and primordially to insight. It's why it's why the act of love is such an illumination sometimes. It isn't the ideas. It's that physiology has an insight into its working. It's like the way that babies become conscious is not through you telling them ideas, through touch and holding and feeding and caring. Babies develop their insight capacity. And a parent can see that, can see the growing insightfulness of the baby. Baby has learned no ideas, but has established a physiological relation. And gains insight through that. So the point is here is that there are two pairs. So when you speak of a quaternary, don't think 1, 2, 3, 4, but think of two pairs coming together. The way I was shown is that it's you hold up a V with each hand and you bring those together so that those four fingers, the index and the mid finger, the one hand, the index and the mid finger, the other hand, that's the structure. That's the quaternary. Like that. I need to jump over here because of time and go to the prologue. They begin, "It is all too easy now to underestimate selves." In other words, by the early 1980s, because there were so many exciting developments in enzyme research and all kinds of subcellular technology and so forth, we began to assume, well, cells are like an old biological phenomenon. Who could be interested in cells? We want to do research on this or that nucleic acid. We don't want to do research or think about the cell. Or we want to look at the larger structures. What about the glands? What is a liver? What does a spleen really do? Those are what interest us. We don't want to go to the cell. So they say here, it's all too easy now to underestimate cells. We have known about them for such large fractions of our lives that for the most part we cease being aware of how remarkable they really are. Almost as soon as we learn our first rudiments of science, we are told that all living beings are formed from cells, that cells come into existence from the growth and division of pre-existing ones, and that they may exist either singly, as unicellular organisms, or as parts of immensely complicated organisms that may contain billions of interacting, highly specialized units. I'll give you a parallel here which may amuse you or at least stimulate some thought. If the cells in our body, if a single cell in our body was as large as this house, our physiological form would reach out to the orbit of Saturn. That's how many cells you have in your body. It would be enough houses to reach out to the orbit of Saturn. That's a long way, friend. It took Voyager 8 years to get there at fantastic speeds. So it has been their potential for great diversity of size, shape, and function that has allowed evolution to proceed in such strikingly different directions. In other words, it's the viable variability of the cell structure that has allowed for life to occur in all of its variety. Notice here, one of the really interesting areas for meditation would be to meditate on single cell organisms, protozoa. To my knowledge, it's not ever been developed. In my experience, it would be literally, if I can use a punning phrase, it would be a protean way of meditating on life. That the symbolic image of a single cell organism would have within it all of the symbolic capacity to affect enlightenment. In other words, a single celled organism would be a complete mandala of life in itself. So if you ever get a chance to get a photograph or a poster of a protozoa or something like that, Eugenia, it might be interesting to sit and meditate with that sometime. All of it should be there. Notice, while it would be more effective to understand it's not essentially necessary because your insight would be able to penetrate. Sometimes one doesn't have to scientifically be able to understand. Roger Bacon, 700 years ago, was able to draw diagrams of egg and spermatozoa making fertilization. We have his diagrams in his manuscripts. There was no way that anyone could have seen that before the 20th century. There was no scientific or physiological way that one could have seen that structure. But in his insight, because he was such a developed psyche, incredibly sophisticated, he was able to see that in his mind's eye, that that was, in fact, the structure of how life dynamically occurred in its beginning. A single cell of each kind coming together. I'll show you a diagram. I have some of the translations of Roger Bacon's material, and you can see the sketches are quite legitimate. 700 years before it could have been done in terms of science and thought. Insight is very accurate. The Buddha's insight into the 16-part structure of a moment of thought is 2,500 years before there was any capacity to express it in terms of brain technology. So they go on and say, the mere cataloging of the different names and unique properties of cells has very limited intellectual appeal. But the textbook dry facts take on new meaning when we first use our simple school microscopes to look at the tiny one-celled creatures like the amoebae or the paramecia that inhabit drops of pond water. Then the cell, as an amazing moving body, comes alive. And it is natural to wonder what exact molecules it is made of and how it can so regularly grow and divide to provide more of its kind. Until the 1950s, however, this objective seemed far beyond our capacities as scientists. Up to then, we had little choice but to focus upon the descriptive morphological approach, using better and better microscopes to reveal more and more cellular structures. A morphological approach is not primordial. A morphological approach deals with vibrational echoes, but not with the primordiality. And when you want to hone your insight, intelligence through your deep self, you don't want to work with a morphological echo. You want to work with the actuality, the primordiality. So you have to make a little bit of adjustment. I know in some circles today, morphological analogs, like Rupert Sheldrake and many of these people, have a great deal of appeal, but I must tell you that there are radical limits to that kind of an approach. Nothing beats having your wholeness activated and brought into contact. Nothing will match that. So until the 1950s, it was beyond people. The double helix came out in 1958. I think all of us were alive in 58, were we not? I think so. To these we frequently gave fancy names like the ergastoplasm or the chondriosomes without understanding why they were there or how they functioned. Not surprisingly, many found this approach unsatisfying and moved on from cells per se to explore the underlying chemical reactions that were becoming increasingly amenable to logical analysis. At this stage, there was a there was a barrier to further consciousness. And the one maverick at the time who was able to overcome this barrier was Linus Pauling. And Linus Pauling was like a divine child in the 1950s. A divine child in the sense that he was mature as an adult in the science of the day, but he didn't believe in it, in the limitations, or that the barrier was real. He was convinced that just around the corner tomorrow, he's going to find the clue that's going to open up the whole structure. And Linus Pauling, even though he's not the one that found the double helix structure, he's the genius whose personal presence made it possible for that discovery by Crick and Watson. In other words, there is always, hermetically speaking, there's always a guest guide who makes it possible for consciousness to happen. Linus Pauling is the guest guide of getting down to the molecular structure of life. And he's a gorgeous human being. These biologists turned biochemists soon discovered how cells use the energy in food molecules to build up new biological molecules, thereby discovering how cells can grow and divide without disobeying the thermodynamic dictum that all chemical reactions must move in the direction that maximizes the production of heat and disorder. Maximizes heat and disorder. Now look here. When you experience life psychologically, what would you call heat and disorder on the scale in which we occur? Frustration and the unknown. Puzzlement and anxiety. Do you understand that trying to get rid of these qualities is a fruitless endeavor? They are characteristic. They're indicators that life is going on. As Zorba the Greek says, life is a problem. That's what it is. It's an ongoing problem. It's a question of interpreting what's happening. And if you can shift around and interpret it as not being threatening to you, but simply an indication that the activity is going on, then you've turned the corner on the whole situation. Then no matter what is going on, is able to occur to you in the accuracy of an observer, at least. Instead of being a victim of the spin-offs of the life process, you at least get to the part where you can become an observer and understand what it is. And have a chance to make that second adjustment where you can become a participator. The science of being, the art of living is the one. The art of living is being able to carry your observational capacity in your own life. But the science of being is being able to assent to your participation in life as a universal unity. There's a whole difference in scale. It's like jumping keys, and one moves to very, very high. There was, however, still great uncertainty about where genes fitted into the chemical picture, and particularly whether they had a direct role in correctly linking together the hundreds of amino acids that make a typical protein molecule. What are protein molecules made of? Amino acids. How this might occur was still conceptually quite unclear as late as the 1940s, and no one expected the incredibly rapid pace at which the nature and transmission of genetic information was worked out between 1953 and 1966. In other words, once the barrier had been entered effectively by 1953, by 1966, just 13 years later, it was pretty well understood. Something that had been a puzzle for all time. No one had ever understood it. Disclosed its complete picture on a certain level in 13 years to a handful of people. There weren't much more than 20 or 30 human beings in that time period who really would have been on top of the whole situation. Today in 1989, there might be 4 or 5 million people who could understand. The jump is not in an additional way, but in a geometric explosion. The problem of world enlightenment is not a problem of aeons of struggle. It's a problem of getting one more generation to make a radical shift. We're not talking about the next 10,000 years. We're talking about one more generation. They write, then with the dominant role of DNA so clearly established, between 53 and 66, what was the synthesizing symbol which ideationally opened up the whole structure? DNA. What about DNA? That DNA had a double helix structure. That no matter how many amino acids, they are limited. It's a big number, but it's limited. And that's, in their shape, that's what a protein is. And the way in which proteins are assimilated into a living structure is through the encoding done by the DNA, which is in a double helix structure, which has large but still finite number, so that eventually, in the double helix, they recount, I've marked off page 56 and page 122, 123, the stunning realization that they could build a model. That as mysterious as life was, the synthesizing structure symbolically was able to be built as a model. And the model of the double helix of DNA was a mask, was on the level of making a mask of what life was. It was a ritual comportment. And the person who encouraged everyone to make this mask was Linus Pauling. He's the one who said, I know it's possible. Everyone's telling us that it's not possible. He's saying, I'm telling you it is possible. Go out and try and do it. And he spoke just about like that, wild-eyed, half-smiling, half-loony, half-genius. That's three halves, and that's Linus Pauling. Look how they write. This is on page 56. But there was no need that day for Hugh to fear a new intellectual invasion. When we walked into the Eagle, Francis did not exchange his usual raucous greetings with the Persian economist Ephraim Ishag, but gave the undistilled impression that something serious was up. The actual model building would start right after lunch, and more concrete plans must be formulated to make the process efficient. So over our gooseberry pie, we looked at the pros and cons of 1, 2, 3, and 4 chains, quickly dismissing one-chain helices as incompatible with the evidence in our hands. As to the forces that held the chains together, the best guess seemed to be salt bridges in which divalent cations like magnesium, Mg++, that's a double ionized held together two or more phosphate groups. Magnesium sulfide, magnesium sulfate, is one of the most primordial chemicals on Earth. It not only operates on the primordial structure as bridge bonding in DNA, in the helical structure, but you can buy it in the store by the pound, drugstores. It's called Epsom salt. They're very similar. One time in Berkeley, because of so much tear gas, and I don't know if you've ever been tear gassed in your life, it's a neutered metallic invasion of your organism. Tear gas gags your whole system, and the psychological reaction to it is to kill the son of a bitch who's doing this to you. I'm speaking not in a profane way, but I'm trying to show you graphically what its effect is on people. And I was trying to find some meditative way to dissolve that anger as well as that invasion, that neutral metallic invasion of the biological organism. And I found that the effective way was to meditate in a tub full of Epsom salt. And that if you did that, for the length of time it took for the Epsom salt solution to reach your tongue, if you maintained your light samadhi for that duration of time, you would be cleaned out of the anger as well as of that non-human, satanic, neutered invasion of a basic part of your being, your respiratory system. It's just a little aside, and it's the way that I was 25 years ago. I needed to know about these kinds of things. What could you do about it? That's how this whole program came out. I wanted to know, what can you do about worldwide ignorance? Is there anything that you can do about it? And as you can see, there is something that can be done. So admittedly, they write, there was no evidence that Rosalind Franklin, that Rosie's samples contained any divalent ions. And so we might be sticking our necks out. On the other hand, there was absolutely no evidence against our hunch. If only the King's groups, King's College, Cambridge, had thought about models, they would have asked which salt was present, and we would not be placed in this tiresome position. But with luck, the addition of magnesium, or possibly calcium ions, to the sugar phosphate backbone would quickly generate an elegant structure, the correctness of which would not be debatable. Our first minutes with the models, though, were not joyous. Even though only about 15 atoms were involved, they kept falling out of the awkward pincers set up to hold them the correct distance from one another. Even worse, the uncomfortable impression arose that there were no obvious restrictions on the bond angles between several of the most important atoms. This was not at all nice. Pauling had cracked the alpha helix by ruthlessly following up his knowledge that the peptide bond was flat. To our annoyance, there seemed every reason to believe that the phosphodiester bonds which bound together the successive nucleotides in DNA might exist in a variety of shapes. At least with our level of chemical intuition, there was unlikely to be any single conformation much prettier than the rest. And of course, they found that there is an exact angle. Rosalind Franklin, one of the forgotten geniuses, was able through her electron microscope photographs to find that, in fact, there is an angle of creation quite exacting, so that the double helix is like a very accurate double staircase going up, every step exactly positioned right. It's like the mystical vision of Jacob's ladder is quite exactly true, that the way that life ascends is on a mystical ladder whose steps are exacting as if placed there eternally by the mind, accurate mind of God. I'm speaking mystically scientifically now. And they found that this was so. After tea, however, a shape began to emerge which brought back our spirits. Three chains twisted about each other in a way that gave rise to a crystallographic repeat every 28 angstroms along the helical axis. This was a feature demanded by Maurice's and Rosie's pictures. So Francis was visibly reassured as he stepped back from the lab bench and surveyed the afternoon's effort. Admittedly, a few of the atomic contacts were still too close for comfort, but after all, the fiddling had just begun. With a few hours more work, a presentable model should be on display. And then on 123 is a diagram of the double helix that they finally came up with. I'll leave it here on the desk. What are we talking about? We're talking about structure. We're talking about the structure of life. We're talking about the way in which human beings pioneer the unknown in this case being a radical barrier forbidding them to understand the structure. And the only way that they could penetrate through this was to work with the limitation in a very particular way. They were shepherded by Linus Pauling's spirit. He's like the guardian spirit of this whole endeavor. There are human beings that can do that. It's not that they're looking over your shoulder and whispering in your ear like a compulsive conscience. That's not it at all. They, in their reality, generate space so that movement is possible and the barriers are permeable. Actual science works exactly in this way. And that's exactly what is spiritual about it. Other than this, it doesn't work. I say it does not work. You don't get anywhere in a lab. Yeah, you have the equipment there, and you have your manuals, your encyclopedias. It won't work. Nothing works. Nothing works. What you pile up is just data, quantity, bales and bales of data. But there's no understanding until that kind of spiritual space is opened by someone. And then it's just like a wind, a fresh wind. Everybody's sail fills and insight works. When I was 22, I was working in the genetics lab at the University of Wisconsin, and all the graduate students were all preparing for their German. They couldn't do their experiments. Well, would you handle them? Yes, I am. So I was running about a dozen experiments in the genetics lab, keeping the records, tending the populations of the rats and the sheep and the and buying the equipment and setting it up and running all of this, everything, distillers and separators, everything, the whole summer. And the data just kept building up and building up. And there was a kind of dullness through the whole lab. It was boring. It was so mediocre and so boring. It was nothing. It became reprehensible just to do it. This was in 1963, in the summer of 1963. And about that time, the final patterns of the DNA operation were coming through. And towards the end of that summer, I remember the big professor there, Cassidy, came in, his gray mustachio just bristling and his eyes wild, because the news had come in that here we've got this real structural pattern to work with, and you could feel the difference in the lab. The next day, everything was crackling. Everything was radiant. Everything was full of promise, like presents waiting to be unwrapped. It was astounding. I remember walking around and just leaning against everything, saying, this is incredible. From one day to the next, what happened was the wind of the spirit started to blow again. Made all the difference in the world. Science was then possible. Before that, there was kind of like a demonic rote technology, which was oppressive. And later, it was like children, divine children again, finding out. It was a totally different thing. Once you've experienced that, you never could mistake it. It was the same place in another dimension. It was the same activity, only this time with man's inner purpose alive and there. We don't have to change the time. We just have to wake them up. So they write here, between 1953 and 1966 came this tremendous breakthrough. Then with the dominant role of DNA so clearly established, it was very tempting to say that by understanding the nucleic acid, we had understood the essence of the living state, and that the greatest challenges of biology had been surmounted. This is a view that we do not share. This prologue being written in 1985, 20 years later, a generation later, by the people that were making this happen. This is a view we do not share. The interconnecting pathways between ATP and DNA, marvelous as they are, do not give us the living cell. In other words, we've got fantastic diagrams. We've got incredible models. We've got masks that, when we dance with these masks, the energy of life happens. But there's something beyond the mask, right? What is that? It's the deep self. It's getting there. It's the living self. It isn't just under the microscope. I'm it. You're it. None of us are exempt. It's lifting everything off the page into life. There's that mysterious, mystical dimension that now, 1985, 1986, 1989, is right there on the vanguard of science. Just like that tension before cracking the model, now there's that tension, that barrier of coming into realization. The 1990s will see it. The next decade will see it. We'll see that quality of spiritual awakening in terms of this discipline. For sure. Why for sure? Because the guiding spirits are working. The guarantee is from them. So they write, they do not give us the living cell. Even the simplest cells are far more complex objects than generally perceived, and vastly more ingenious than any computerized intelligent machine yet designed. That this is so is strongly hinted at by simple observation. Notice the term observation. Notice also in your recollection that observation is the middle turn. It's the fulcrum turn. There's an even more powerful impress in participation. What the 1990s will disclose in terms of observational accuracy in another generation or two, sometime in the first third of the 21st century, will be put into a participatory mode. We may not live to see it, but our children will, definitely. This observational mode is the key to making a planetary culture. The participatory mode is the key to making an interstellar civilization. There's just that relationship between them.